Accession number 14834, Reel 2.
Mr. Andrew, Reel 2.
Yes. Well, we got to we went from Scampton. I went with this crew from Scampton. He was an Australian, and there was all, I think they were all Australians except the wireless operator, and I think he was English. But I'm not too sure about it. Yes, I'm sure he was. And so when we got to Wigsley, I lost then because of to do this time on the Stirling. They went on ahead, and I formed up then with a Canadian crew after the week ground instruction. And the Canadian was a flight lieutenant, no, a flying officer Smith, a fruit farmer from Canada, and they were mainly Canadian crew. And we went to, we did the course on the Stirling, and then went to five-length finishing school at Syston, near Newark again, and but the other side of Newark. And then I started training there with them, and I got trouble with one ear, and I had to go to hospital, and I was 3 weeks sick with this ear trouble, and they had to go on without me. And one day, when I got pronounced fit, I went down the to the flight offices, and there was a chap there looking for an engineer, and he was only a very small chap. He was 19 years old, Ray Harris. And I thought, good Lord, I wonder. And yet he turned out to be tops, really. He really was a good pilot. And I stayed with him for all my operations. The two crews that I'd been in, I think one went down after four trips and one went down after eight, so I was lucky there. The flying officer Smith, I learnt later, he'd been shot down somewhere over France, and he'd joined the Mackie, the French resistance, and he drove a lorry for them until the Americans liberated that part of France. And I never saw him again because he came back to London. He was only in London a couple of days, and he flew back to Canada. And then I got, of course, and then I got on the squadron at Bardney. And we did a sort of a checkout with the flight commander, and he accepted us into his flight, and we did some practice bombing trips, and then we started on operations.
When did you start on operations?
Well, nearly straight away, within a few days. It was in May, and we did quite a few up to D-Day. And then,
do you remember your first operation?
Oh, yeah. I remember going over the channel, and I saw the first thing I saw was a flak ship sending tracer up about, it must have been 10 miles away. And that worried us a bit, you see. But of course, it was nothing to what we were going to see later. And we wouldn't even probably have, it wouldn't have been worth comment when we'd done about four or five. But that first time to see they were actually shooting at us, it just made you wonder, you know.
Where were you going to on that operation? In France?
So it was a French one, yes, I think. Yes, it was a French one, but I can't remember where.
Were all your first operations on French targets?
Oh, no. We did Stuttgart and Karlsruhe. They were nasty ones.
Do you remember what happened on those?
Well, they were fairly high altitude main force bombing raids. It was like a gigantic fireworks display, I suppose is the best way you can describe it. And they dropped these lanterns down each side of the bomber stream so they could silhouette, the fighters could silhouette you against them, you know. And it was a bit hairy, but luckily we never got hit on either of those two. But we saw a lot go down.
What did the aircraft look like as they went down?
Gradually got to be a ball of fire and sometimes blew up.
Did it shake morale?
Not really, no. Morale was very good. I never heard anybody say, oh, I'm not going tonight or anything like that. No, no, I never did hear of that. In all the time I was training and the comparatively short time I was on operations, there were two people went for what we used to call LMF, Lacrimal Fibre, and one was during training. He'd never even got, before he'd never even flown at all in his life. And he packed up. And then we'd one on the squadron. But I think he'd got a lot of sinus trouble and it used to bother him. And I think in his case he'd given up because he didn't like risking his crew, knowing very well that if he got an attack of that, he would find it difficult to land the aircraft. And I think that's really why he packed up. But whether it was that or LMF, I never really knew. They tended to disappear very quickly if they went sent straight off the squadron if they got anything like that, you see, because it could spread, couldn't it? You know?
What did you and the others feel about LMF cases? Was there any sympathy for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially if they'd had a bad trip or anything like that, or in the case of this chap where it was probably medical rather than actual cowardice, it was probably medical, you know, that he'd had one or two bad attacks.
Can we now go on to the raid that you made on the Tirpitz?
Yes. Well, we were at Bardney, and of course we were told that the Tirpitz, merely by being in the area up in the north of Norway, was such a menace to the Arctic convoys to Russia that they've got to keep at least one battleship on station all the time, which in fact meant two battleships because they couldn't stay out there indefinitely. They've got to go back for various reasons, unserviceability and whatnot. So it really tied at least two battleships up, several cruisers, a large number of destroyers, and they hadn't a carrier that they could send because of part of the threat was also the air, from the air. But it was imperative they got rid of the Tirpitz if possible, because the other ships that were tied up there were desperately needed elsewhere, especially in the Pacific. And so they decided that we couldn't reach the Tirpitz from the UK direct, because she was right up in Caer Fjord. And the only thing they could think of was for us to go to Russia and bomb from there. And that's what we did. They lightened the aircraft as much as possible. And we had a full petrol load. A 12,000-pound bomb. And various bits of material such as trestles and oil drums and whatnot that were needed when we got there to service the aircraft. And we flew direct to Archangel, I believe, the first time in the White Seaport of Archangel. And when we got there, the cloud was right down on the ground, the visibility was terrible, and we couldn't find Yadignik, which was the name of the airfield, Russian Naval Air Station, I understand. We couldn't find it, but we did see an airfield with no runways, and so we got to land or fall out of the sky for fuel. So we landed there and we tore across the airfield and we touched down far too late. And we ended up in a potato field, I think it was. It was like rows of something, whatever. We ended up with the aircraft on its nose and the tail in the air and four bent propellers. And we got out as quickly as we could because we weren't too sure about fire or the bomb. And we got out and we were met by some Russians. None of whom could speak English, and we couldn't speak Russian. I had a bit of schoolboy French, which wasn't very good, but I could probably have got through. And a fellow came along out of another aircraft that had landed there, and I think they called him Guy Warriner, and he was a war correspondent who later, I believe, was killed at Arnhem. He could speak German, and he managed to explain to the Russians that who we were and what we were doing there, and they took us into their mess and they fed us quite well, and the meat I remember was goat, but it was very very good, very tasty, and we had Kai, they call it, the tea. It was Russian tea, weak tea, but no sugar. They hadn't any sugar at all. And eventually we got into one of the serviceable aircraft, and when the weather cleared, we flew to Yadignik, which was only a few miles away, and we landed there. And they put us in some like dugouts lined with tungsten groove boarding, thin tungsten groove boarding, and we were all right in there, quite comfortable. The only companions we had was some wood lice, and there was a big roaring fire at one end, and because it was fairly cold even then, and they had a Russian, either a rating, Russian rating, or a Russian female rating, I suppose she was, used to tend the fire for us and generally keep an eye on us, I suppose. And all the senior chaps went into a paddle steamer that was built on the Clyde. And when they came out in the morning, they were all covered in big red blobs, and there's some insects on there had played havoc with them during the night. And I remember they got an American liaison officer came over with a Dakota, and he said, "Anything I can do for you?" And they explained what had happened, and he came with some cylinders on his back and fumigated the paddle steamer, and they didn't have much trouble after that. But. And of course we had a mosquito with us photographic reconnaissance mosquito. I went to the target each day to observe weather conditions, and spring them at smoke pots if he could get them to operate them, because on the day if he did it, they wouldn't have got them loaded again by the time the raid took place, because they put a big smoke screen over the area, you see. And also with a Liberator, with the it carried some, I think, two spare Merlin engines, and the ground crews they carried. I think there may have been two Liberators. I think there was, but they carried some ground crew with them. You see, to do the aircraft. And the trouble was, in landing, there was 13 had either lost or unserviceable, including ours. But I think seven of them were repaired and flown back. And so we just sat and waited for the mosquito to come back with a favourable report. But unfortunately, we couldn't take part in the raid because of the aircraft being unserviceable.
Can you tell me about the kind of bomb that was dropped on this raid?
Well, we carried the 12,000-pounder. I'd maybe better explain that. Sometime after D-Day, we were called to a briefing, and there were some quite senior officers there. I can't remember just who. I know Wing Commander Tater 617 was one of them, and they explained that they needed a second squadron to carry the 12,000-pound Tallboy bomb, and because we got the best bombing record for that particular month, according to the photographs we'd brought back. The target photographs we brought back, we've been selected as that squadron, and from then on we flew as partners with 617 squadron to the end of the war. Well, the squadron did, 9 squadron. Well, most of the aircraft did carry the 12,000-pound bomb, but I understand there was a... We took with us an Army warrant officer, I think, designed this new type of bomb, and at least if he hadn't designed it, he was there to advise on it. And I never knew his name, but apparently you drop the bomb in the ordinary way, upstream of a target, of a marine target, obviously, and when it got down to a certain height off the ground, a parachute opened, and the bomb then floated down into the water and hit the water. The parachute detached, and the bomb sank. After a while, and it could happen quite a few times, I never knew how many, but quite a number of times this sequence could happen. When the bomb had been in the water for a while, gases formed and it became buoyant and came up fairly quick. And it had a 400-pound warhead, and if that had hit the underneath soft plates of the tirpitz, it would have done a lot of damage. And of course, if it came up and then sank again without hitting it, it would each time it would drift with the tide, and hopefully, on one of the times it came up, it would come up under something. It was a bit hit and miss, but if you dropped a lot of them, you had a chance of success, you see.
That raid was the 11th of September 1944.
That's right, yes. Yeah, September, yeah.
Can you tell me more about the conditions in Russia as you witnessed them and what you thought?
Well, I think they were very, very short of all sorts of things. I remember somebody dropped a cigarette end and this Russian civilian immediately dashed forward and picked it up, you know. So they were obviously short of cigarettes. I remember the rubles were 42 to a pound, and the only thing I could buy in a souvenir shop in Archangel was an egg cup, hand-painted egg cup, and I got 7 ruble notes for it. Sorry. Oh, keep catching. Because we were well fed, but the meat was always goat. We saw them killing the goats on the station, and but the food was quite reasonable. We enjoyed the food, and we were well treated. And we used to go to the All Ranks Club at night, and there they had the Russian films on, mainly newsreels of the war and that kind of thing. And then after that, they cleared everything away and had a dance. But the band was a brass band, for the station band, I suppose. But it was quite enjoyable. We all enjoyed it.
Did you?
And they made us very welcome. They seemed to be pleased to have us there.
Did you get any impression of the kind of work they were doing in the area?
Well, no, because apart from going to our own aircraft, we never went anywhere on the airfield. We never went on the airfield at all at night. Two of the chaps went to fetch some blankets one night out of the aircraft, and they were shot at, so they came back without going any further. Well, they fired anyway. I suppose they fired in the air, but they let them know that on no circumstances was anybody to go on the airfield at night. And during the day, we just used to go to our own aircraft, run the engines up and then come back. We never really saw much going on. There didn't seem to be much flying going on. There was an old biplane flying about there a bit, but I never saw anything else. Oh, and a Catalina flying boat that took the... when the aircraft crashed or belly landed in the swamp, the flying boat took Russian guides out and parachuted them down to help them find the way back.
I think that you had an unfortunate shooting accident whilst we were there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we all had these Smith & Wesson 38, and we came across a Russian sergeant and a Russian, I think it was a sergeant. I don't know the ranking signals very well, but I think at the time we said he was a sergeant or equivalent. And they were firing with pistols at this target. It was a sort of improvised range. And, of course, we said, well, we'll have a go at this, you know, and we scrounged a few spare rounds of ammunition over the months we'd been, because sometimes we used to go do practice at Bardney on the range sort of thing. And we got a few rounds each. And we had a go with this Russian and the these two Russians. And when we'd finished, we'd just got one bullet left each that wasn't accountable. We had the normal issue, but we'd only one spare round each. And we fired it. When we came back to the dugout, the place we lived, we fired at the chimney. And Sandy Sanders, the rear gunner, he was the only one that hit this chimney. And we heard the bullet ricochet, but it didn't ricochet very far. And when we got round the end of the, came round the end of the dugout, there was this Russian woman, she was actually on her knees holding her chest. And apparently the bullet had hit her. But we were very lucky because it only just bruised. It didn't penetrate, but must have given her a nasty smack. And the poor old girl was the one that carried the water for our billet. But we had a bit of chocolate and things like that we gave her, and she seemed to be come round all right, and I don't think she was very badly hurt anyway. But we were very worried because to kill somebody in a foreign country, it could have been very serious. And we didn't want to hurt anybody anyway. But to our way of looking at it, you see, we were firing out over countless miles of swamp. There was nothing there at all, as far as the eye could see. But the bullet had hit the chimney and turned down over the other side of the dugout, and that's where she was. It should have gone over the top of her, you see. We didn't even know she was there, obviously. We shouldn't have fired. But
what do you think she was doing?
Pardon?
What do you think she was doing?
She was bringing water for us, carrying it, you know.
How did you get back from Russia?
Well, the aircraft that we flew out in, we put on its nose, wasn't serviceable. And some of the crews had gone off to try and salvage stuff from the aircraft that were in the swamp. They'd got a bit of an expedition and they'd took as many as they could get to go with them to carry things, you see. And the crew of this aircraft had gone, and it was serviceable, N9 it was. It was serviceable, so we were available and we flew it back. Uneventfully, apart from, I think through the Skagerrak, I think the Swedes fired at us, but they put a barrage up on one side, you know, token barrage. They never tried to hit us. And that's the only thing we saw all the way back, with a very uneventful flight back. And we must have passed a lot of potential dangers without being seen.
Now, I think a bit later, on the 7th of October 44, you went on an attack to Flushing. Does that stand out in your mind?
On when?
To attack Flushing.
Yes, I did go to Flushing. We went twice there. And we bombed twice there, two separate bombing runs, I remember that. Well, that was to let the sea defences in on the Germans, as well as knock the gun positions about a bit. So we took 1,000 pounders for the gun positions, and we took 4,000 cookie for the sea defences. So we did two sort of operations in one there.
Did it seem to be successful?
Oh yes, it was successful. Yeah.
Was there much?
Well, we were told it was. Yeah.
Was there much enemy opposition?
Yeah, quite a bit there. It was quite nasty for a while. Well defended. But it wasn't like some targets, you see, whereas if you came in from the sea, you've got a very short sort of opposition, whereas if you gone in over the land, you could have opposition all the way, couldn't you? So that's what I mean. You've got guns in between you and the target, but at sea, you're in and out fairly quick, so from that point of view, it wasn't so bad, except that we went round twice.
I think you met somebody after the war.
Oh yes,
which has relevance to this raid.
Yeah, well, I took a little minesweeper into Flushing, and when I got there, they invited us to drinks in the wardroom, and when I went in, they asked me, told me the captain of the base wanted to see me, and I went up there, and he gave me a Heineken, and He explained to me that he'd been in Holland all through the war. He was younger than me quite a bit.
He was a Dutchman, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he'd been in Holland during the war. He wasn't in the Navy then. And him and his family had luckily had survived without any losses or harm. And then after the war, he came over to England and joined the RAF and did his training and then went back to form the Dutch Naval Air Service, the flying side of it, sort of thing, you know. And he was a very nice chap, and he made us very, very welcome. And when I didn't know whether to mention it or not, and then I thought, well, I may as well. I'll chance me luck sort of thing. And I told him that I'd actually bombed Flushing during the war, and he showed me photographs of all the damage that had been done in all numerous areas. It was nearly flattened. And that's as near as I've ever been to examining a target.
Did you go back to attack the tar pits?
Yes, we half expected it. We thought they'll not let it rest at that. It was a bit indecisive, and they didn't know really at the time, I think, that the Germans had virtually given up hope of ever getting her serviceable as a battleship again, and that she was going to be. Apparently, when she went to Tromso, they put a false. Well, they got a dredger to fill on underneath so that she couldn't sink completely, and they were going to keep her as a more or less as a fortress, I think, but there's always a possibility she could be repaired, I suppose. And we did one or two trips, I think we did the Karlsruhe at that time while we were waiting to go again. And then after the Russian raid, the reconnaissance found she'd been moved from Caire down to Tromso, which meant she was 200 miles nearer to the UK. And so what they did, they collected a lot of, or as many as was necessary, of Merlin, Packard-built Merlins, the Merlin 24s, and they fitted these in the aircraft. That some had them in, but those that hadn't, the Mark One, there were some Lancaster Threes, but the all the Mark Ones were converted to Mark Threes merely by putting the higher powered Merlins, Packard Merlins, in. They did that for a start. They did that in 3 days, I understand, and then they took the mid upper turret off, and the rear turret, and they slid this long tank right inside the fuselage. And it held 250 extra gallons. And then they left the mid-upper turret off, and they fared it over with, I think, canvas. I think they put a sort of a structure over it and then covered it with canvas, covered the mid-upper turret over. And then we took the 12,000-pound bomb with the extra fuel, and on that trip, fully laden, we were over 2 tons overweight. And we flew up to Kinloss. I think 617 Squadron, I believe, went to Lossiemouth, but we went to Kinloss, I believe. And from there we flew to Tromso. And I remember